Welcome to the In Conversation with Expo Stars podcast. I am Lee Ali, founder and MD of Expo Stars Interactive, an award-winning global live marketing and exhibition engagement agency. This is a podcast about leading the way in the live marketing industry and in business. In every episode, we speak to people around the world who do absolutely amazing work. You'll find an eclectic mix of stories and valuable insights on audience engagement, sales and marketing, mindset and well-being, business growth, and much more. We've been active in the live marketing industry for well over a decade now, and over that time, we've been very fortunate and privileged to have met and worked with a diverse range of inspiring business people. We ask them thought-provoking questions and share with you their valuable insights. We want to inspire you to transform your live marketing, engage your audience, grow your business, and enjoy the process. Happy listening. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 3 of In Conversation with Expo Stars. And in the last episode, we talked about communication with Ashley. And on this episode, we're going to continue that theme, but we're going to look at international communication. Obviously, the world has changed with how we communicate and build relationships. We have no longer got events, live events. We can no longer go to personal meetings. So how can we build effective relationships, international relationships, using virtual meetings like Zoom, when we're attending virtual events and virtual exhibitions. So my special guest today is Terry Morrison, and I'm going to have to read through her list of accomplishments because it is quite lengthy. So my guest today is Terry Morrison. She is the author of Kiss, Bow and Shake Hands, the best-selling guide to doing business in over 60 countries. She's been the author of the Dun & Bradstreet's Guide to Doing Business Around the World. And she's also taken her book into the element of sales and marketing and also courtrooms and corporate councils. I had the pleasure of meeting Terry at the Exhibitor Live event in 2019, I think it was, Terry. So it's amazing how time has actually flown. And Terry is a keynote speaker. She's worked with the people like Boeing, Citicorp, Sanofi, MetLife, and her book is given to new hires at firms like Ernst & Young, Lockheed & Martin as well. And I thought when I met Terry, having worked internationally for the last 20 years, that I actually knew a lot about international customs, business customs, and nuances and so on. But when I met Terry, she kind of blew my mind away. And I ended up buying her book, Kiss, Bow and Shake Hands. And it's been an absolutely fantastic. How are you, Terry?
I'm wonderful, Lee. Thank you for inviting me today. And that was a fun event when we worked together at Exhibitor Live. That was outstanding.
Yeah, we were looking forward to actually attending this time last year, and obviously it got postponed, and we now hope to be there in October later on this year. And I've got an opportunity to do a talk myself at the event, so that's I'm really looking forward to that, and finally getting to go to a live event. So obviously, like I said before, how we do business internationally over the last 12 months has tremendously changed. We're now relying on virtual tools, virtual exhibitions, and so on. So tell us a bit more about the kind of mistakes that you've come across over the 12 months that businesses are making when trying to connect with an international audience.
Well, what we're doing right now with this kind of communication that's totally virtual is rife with trouble. You know, just initially, I'm not even sure if people are going to see this Zoom that we're doing, but you can tell that some people get way too close to the camera, and that's the equivalent feeling of having some, look at you, you're moving back. but that's the equivalent of someone getting too close to you personally in real time, in real space. And so how I've set this up for me is a little bit more comfortable, which would be about 2 feet, you know, in the US. And that would be at least a bit more comfortable. However, what it does is it allows you to see a whole lot more of my environment.
Yeah.
And that brings up that question of privacy in these virtual communications. I'm sure that many people who are using this kind of mode of communication use virtual screens like you do. And I don't. And I'm just wondering, why are you more comfortable with the virtual environment behind you? Yeah, and what is that?
So behind me is, you know, a screenshot of an exhibition. But I remember about 6 months ago, I was having a conversation with somebody and said, oh, you're using a virtual background. And my immediate response was, well, I don't feel comfortable in letting strangers into my house, okay, because I'm not, you know, when you get to know people at a deeper level, then you feel comfortable inviting them back to your house for a, you know, a bit of lunch or a bit of evening get together or something like that. But when you don't know people, naturally, you're more inclined to not let them in and see the, you know, the inside of your house. So I think that reflects quite in the real world as well, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, because I've had jokes with friends from the UK or Germany that, sure, I'll invite you over after I know you for a decade or so, you know, it takes a long time. Because privacy is just so paramount in some environments. And here, I'm in the Philadelphia area, okay, in Pennsylvania. But so maybe there aren't as many people that would look inside my house in the Philly area normally. But if I were from the South, this would be the first thing that you would have happen is you'd be invited over to have a bite to eat or chat or whatever, meet the neighbors. So it really is what makes one comfortable, I think. And that affects how you communicate. So for me, yes, you're inside a room that used to belong to one of my children, and now it's the office, and you can see old typewriters, and because I'm a writer, you know, and, and my father actually worked in a Bundy typewriter when he was in college years ago. He put himself through school fixing old typewriters, and I've got them. So it's kind of, you know, it's a sense of stability for me and comfort. And that makes a major difference on how you're able to make ideas come across. If you feel comfortable, your voice is modulated in a normal manner. The more stress that people get under, you'll notice on Zooms that they overlap each other, you know, they interrupt. Even when two people know that there's supposed to be a timeout where, you know, it's your turn to speak and your turn, sometimes you'll get people who interject and you can't hear anyone at that point because it just cuts out, right? So it's really easy to have that agita increase and your voice goes up and maybe you get a little too loud. And so you really want to concentrate on breathing and communicating as clearly and concisely as you possibly can. And that's encouraged by being comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think if you feel comfortable with your background and also tells a story, doesn't it, about you, the person, in terms of like you just described, you've got, I saw that old typewriter there and I thought, obviously, she's a writer. And it's quite iconic as well. And yeah, you're absolutely right. So tell us, how did you, I'm quite intrigued with the history of Kiss, Bow or Shake Hands. When did you decide to write that book and how did it come about?
It was the first one is the big red one. You know, it's about 600 pages. It's huge. It's actually derived from the digital product. I had a database first before there were ebooks or anything. I was working for Booz Allen and Hamilton, And my boss at that time, I had known for a long time, and there were some issues that really were culturally based that they were asking me to talk about or learn about. And so I thought, well, if I built this framework of content, you know, with business practices and protocol and a history of the country and maybe some cultural orientation data, which is really cultural anthropological data, I asked, would they buy it? And he said, yes. And so I quit and started this company before there was the internet, before there were eBooks, before all, it was 1990. Yeah. So the digital product was built in Micro Basic back in the day. And I gave myself like 6 months to get my first contract. And in 5 months, I had AT&T and DuPont. So it ran on little microcomputers in their language divisions and research divisions. And they were the reason, because they didn't want to have to keep printing out all of these countries. They said, you need to make binders or something horrendous. And I said, I can't make binders. So I got a book that's really good. If you have any colleagues or listeners who want to be writers, there's a book called The Writer's Market, and it has all these publishers in it. Yeah. And that's what I use to look for international business book publishers. And that's what I did. I just sent query letters to, I don't know, maybe a dozen. And I had a couple of offers within 4 weeks. So that was great. That's how I started this. And then we've gotten other books in the series. And so by now we're almost at 500,000 books.
Wow. Okay. That's quite a journey. And it's amazing how relevant it still is. With, you know, obviously the way we do business has been changing over the last, 20, 30 years, but communication and international customs and cultures, they've kind of remained static, haven't they? So it's very, very important for businesses to realize that, you know, they need to take these cultures into account when they're actually looking to go into new markets.
Right. And even if you're standing in a booth, in a virtual booth or a real booth in October, hopefully that works out. Yeah. You need to know the signals that someone is giving you non-verbally and verbally, whether it's they're subtly asking you a question and you need to pick up on it, whether they're not going to say directly, no, I'm not interested. They might say something like, I'll have to check with corporate or let me get back to you. Or because there are plenty of cultures in Asia, in Latin America, that will not say no to your face, right? I'm sure you've been to Asia and Indonesia, and
I've had that experience, and we've done a couple of seminars, I should say, in the UAE, and also Malaysia and Thailand as well. And people there are reluctant to say no; they don't want to say no to you. So you have to obviously make sure that, you know, the conversations that you're having is that you get, you know, some kind of buy-in and understanding of from your prospects in front of you. So it's, you will know what you don't want to happen is you make a trip all the way to Thailand and people say yes to you all the time. Mm-hmm. And then you come back and then you never hear from them again.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's important to know how to phrase that question. Yeah. So if they have, it's kind of basic if you are prepared and you give them options and then they can select which path, you know, do you like this or would that be preferable or how would you advise? This is the go-to question that I've used is what would you advise me to do?
Yeah.
So you're the driver now.
Yeah.
And then I abide by whatever it is that they tell me to do, because it's really hard to get somebody to be definitive. in Thailand, which I love Thailand. Were you in Bangkok or Chiang Mai or?
Bangkok, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bangkok, yeah. So looking at that, so let's use a situation. Let's say you're a consultancy business and you want to look at the US, you want to look at the Middle East, and you want to look at Asia, and you want to look at Germany as potential markets, you know, for your services. How would you change your approach, you know, given each one of the four regions? What kind of advice would you give that consultancy business if they're looking at those four different kind of areas to optimize their sales strategy for those regions?
From a sales standpoint, when you do a presentation in the US to start with, it's inductive, it's called. So I lead with the decision. I tell you, this is the best product. Or if you're buying a house right now, you're going to love this house because ABC. I give you the answer. That's the antithesis of Germany, for example. And you'd think we'd be very similar because we're both direct, very honest cultures, very concise, very, very transactional. Okay. Yeah. But Germany is like France in the fact that if you want them to be interested in your product, you have to show them your work. You have to let them deduce the answer. Because if you try and push them in a direction where, let me tell you what you want, you know, they are just going to shut down. And if they're French, they're probably going to, you know, eviscerate you in a few ways because, you know, you're assuming that they don't have the intellect to make their own decision. Yeah. So it's that way in their legal systems too. So we have in the US, we have common law. So you use juries and you have your lawyers are antagonistic at the, you know, and the judge sort of watches the whole process and then steps in at the end. And in, of course, Germany or France, you've got civil law, and the lawyers really don't play as major of a part. There's no witness preparation.
Yeah.
There's no juries, and the judge is really the massive arbiter. And so when you consider that, that's based on their concepts of logic as well. So if you're selling, you know, in Germany, you're going to use that, which I just told you, the deductive approach. And you're also going to have to show your evidence to the judge. You don't try and persuade the judge like you would here, or a jury pool, which they wouldn't have. So just those two enormous contrasts, you would lead with all your data in Germany. You'd lead with your scientific evidence, all of your research, show them your models, and have a lot of mathematical basis in it, facts. And in the US, you're going to also show a lot more sizzle, and you're going to make it a more persuasive approach with a lot more graphics that might have other kinds of innuendos in it. So just those two cultures. I could go on different ones because, again, you've got different legal systems in the other environments you're talking about, Sharia law in the Middle East or the rule of law in China. And all of those, again, are hooked to, is it a relationship-based culture? Yeah. Is it religious? Does God tell you what to do in the UAE? He does, or she does. Yeah. So that's a big, deep question. You might not have thought I'd go into details.
Absolutely. And in Asia, just to add to that, I think the hierarchy plays a massive role, doesn't it, in the decision-making process. So if you're selling to a middle management, you have to be prepared to wait until you're formally introduced to the upper echelons of the management before you can actually get a decision.
Yes, you're right. And you also are working in a consensus-based culture there. Yeah. So depending upon which country you're in, If it's a Japan, for example, you have a whole lot of people that are going to be involved in that decision. And then it moves up the ladder, yes, to the hierarchical structure. But if you don't pass muster with the general group, you're done already. Yeah. So whereas in the US, you know, you probably have, most clients have middle management decision-making authority up to a certain budget, right? Yeah. So maybe $100,000 or something, you don't have to go above them. But yeah, you do. You have to run it all the way around in many Asian cultures. And the weird thing is that people don't give that validity. They don't allow enough time for that to happen in anywhere from India to Malaysia. You have to be a little bit more patient because so many people will be involved.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% spot on. So let's move on to the virtual world then, in terms of how do you successfully build relationships virtually when you don't have the physical elements anymore? So what advice would you give to businesses here in the UK and the US or anywhere else internationally? What kind of things should we be looking at when we're trying to build relationships virtually?
It's very challenging, but it's really, again, about engagement, I think. When you see something like this, an interesting podcast, because we're both contributing, we're going back and forth. And you could also get your listeners engaged by saying, okay, well, we're going to have a little quiz now or a contest or fill in this blank or here's a crossword or something. And then you give away something so that it engages people, whether it's a prize or it's a follow-up bit of data, something has to hook them.
Yeah.
And in the US, unfortunately, we're known for lecturing in our, right? Should I
say
that?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So it's hard to stop us too.
Yeah.
So it's very, it can get dull quickly. And then that point, you know, you're not going to get other people to participate as much. Yeah. It's a very difficult format. I don't know how you handle that, but, you know, offering people an opportunity to type in their questions, having another moderator that interjects at that juncture. It's very challenging when you have more than, say, 10 people on the Zoom call too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the more people you have, the less personal it gets, okay? And the less engagement that you actually have, because I'm not sure if you realize with when you do a virtual event, the challenge is keeping their attention because they're free to do whatever they want because you haven't got that control as you would on a trade show booth, for example. Okay, so I think people are having coffee. Sometimes they'll switch the camera off. They actually have a lot of control over the situation, okay? So I think it's very, very important what you say is that you actually have really good engagement tools and actually have an interactive conversation. So involve them as much as possible. And what I tend to see a lot of is when people are doing webinars, it's all one way. And I think the other challenge that business, I was actually on a Zoom event with Exhibitor Magazine last week, and they were showing that the people who do virtual events or the sponsors or the people who've actually participated in a virtual exhibition, the return on investment and the struggle to get people from attending the talks to actually get them on a virtual booth has been absolutely difficult because people don't want to go into a room to be actually sold to.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's even the body language that you're good at, I'm okay. But when you think about how do you become more effective with communicating through this teeny little camera that's up on there, I've worked with folks from the theater a good bit. And if you think, I don't know if you've ever seen Hamilton or heard about the musical Hamilton that's so big over here.
Yeah.
But when the guy who plays King George, he comes out and he's got brilliant control of his body, right?
Yeah,
his eye contact is the first thing you notice because it is riveting.
Yeah.
It's direct. And when he moves his eyes, it's on purpose across the front row, right? And it's very rare that he will blink even. Yeah. And he's singing, right?
Yeah.
And
his
body language is so in a encapsulated environment like this, he would make no move that wasn't purposeful. They actually call it, you're doing a body check. Okay.
Yeah.
Dancers do it and everything. So, excuse me. So the capacity that we have that we don't use in these kinds of webinars or Zoom meetings is to try and keep those people interested in looking at us.
Yeah.
And also make them aware that I can see you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when somebody is sitting there chugging, you know, a nice stout that they've got in Ireland at the moment or wherever, or eating or whatever, that has an impact on all of the other attendees who can see you.
Yeah.
In other words, you're not paying attention.
Absolutely.
You're enjoying yourself. You might have your feet up. The kids come. There's some things you can't help.
Yeah.
Children come in, pets bark, they deliver a FedEx or something. But there are things that we can control. And one of them is basic etiquette, basic protocol.
Yeah.
Do you really need to have that gigantic mug of water or whatever with you while you're on this? You could turn the screen off for a second and go get a drink. There's just basic things that people don't think about taboos as much in a virtual environment. And that's why you'll see so much of the inappropriate posts on Twitter and so forth. They figure, well, you don't really know me. You don't see me.
Yeah.
And so I can say whatever I want. And
and
it does come back and bite you.
Absolutely. I think people as well, with the world of the internet, they've got into a habit of hiding behind the screen as well. With some of the, obviously, the social media language that we hear about. And do we really get a true reflection of who people are when you're actually talking to them virtually, do you think?
What an interesting thought. Probably you get, you could get more of a realistic view if they're relaxed and they're thinking, oh, well, there's 100 people in this meeting. Nobody's going to see me anyway, or I can turn this off. You see things that you would never see in the office, right? Or in a booth.
Yeah.
However, if you are used to doing presentations in a sales environment or in a booth, or you interact with people normally in a very public forum speaking somewhere, I think you're even more aware that this presentation could be recorded and last in perpetuity.
Yeah.
And there you will be 50 years from now.
Absolutely.
Doing something weird on this Zoom meeting. So for those who aren't normally comfortable with speaking in public, you'll see them just mute or turn off their camera very, very quickly, quite often. And that's tough because, again, the way that I like to engage people is to give them information prior to the event, right? Here's where you can ask some questions and write them down and I'll address them in the Q&A or in the meeting. I also welcome them into the first little meeting room I did was I had a flip chart and I just stood there. I said, can you tell me what you think about executives from the United States, they started telling me and I wrote them down and it stayed there. And then you could do that for any topic with any culture. And
absolutely,
it's just, it's a starting point where they're engaged.
Absolutely. I think having that interactivity is absolutely vital to getting engagement and getting people's attention. Because at the end of the day, as I always say, what we're looking for is attention and time, okay? Because if you don't arouse that curiosity, they're not going to give you time. So they will go on mute and they will actually press the hide button, take the camera off, and so they'll just be passive, okay? And what you want them to do is be more interactive and interested in what you're actually saying. So it's absolutely essential that you use as many tools as you have at your disposal to get that interactivity. So let's go back to, you mentioned the word taboos, in terms of cultures, and reading your book, you've actually got a lot of four powers in there. Can you give us any examples that you've come across where businesses have actually made a really big four power that has actually affected their business deal or their relationship with their prospective customers?
Sure. Every major firm has done something. You could go from Coca-Cola to the U.S. government. There was a massive problem in Afghanistan because the U.S. military was trying to build a relationship with the families and the children. So they thought, oh, we'll just toss soccer balls out. Yeah.
I read about
helicopters,
that. Yeah. Right. They actually had the flag of a country on there.
They had the flag of Saudi Arabia on one of the facets of the balls because they had all of the flags that are in the World Cup on the balls. And Allah's name is on the flag of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So not only are you desecrating Allah's name on a flag, on a promotional item, but you kick that with your foot, which is the most unclean part of the body, that you would see in the Middle East and the Indian subcontinent and much of Asia. So that's just, and then you think, how would we not know that? I mean, we've been working around the world. We have so many people in, and it's just that one concept of here, we're doing something publicly and you don't validate it in country. You have to make sure you have a local individual who gives you a vetting process that you believe. Yeah. And so it could be using the wrong map in having the Spratly Islands on something, or having, and you're working with China, or you could have image of a man and a woman together. In some sort of setting that's not appropriate in the UAE.
Yeah.
And that's taboo, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or you could put dogs on things that, in countries that the dog is seen as unclean. And then in the UK, it's the most wonderful pet in the world, right?
Yeah, so absolutely. Yeah.
So there's animals, there's symbols, symbols like just when there was this massive investment in a new World Trade Center in Shanghai, the architect thought, wouldn't it be neat to put a moon gate at the top of the new tower? And yet you had these investors from China and all of these people sitting on the board at the first meeting when the architect presented the plans, and they all sat back like with their arms crossed, like, no, because it looked like, the flag of Japan flying over Shanghai. So there's this individual who's doesn't have those sensibilities because he didn't grow up there. He's not from an environment that has ever actually been overrun by a foreign concern. So his sensibilities were not to do any research into symbolism. Now, what they did is they just made it into like a rectangle at the top, and it's now the Shanghai World Trade Center, and it's so popular, they call it the bottle opener.
Yeah.
And, they sell these in the gift shop. So, it doesn't take a lot to avoid those kind of things, but all you need to do is one substantial one, and you've lost the credibility that you're trying so hard to build with these clients.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of just to obviously, I could talk to you all day about international customs. So just to wrap up our conversation, if you had to give three pieces of advice to businesses looking to go into a new market and obviously use virtual communication as a tool, what would those three key pieces of advice be from you?
I would offer the content up ahead of the event to start with. Disseminate as much information as you possibly can so that they can formulate questions in writing for you, because English may not be their first language, right? And it's very difficult to stop a meeting and ask a question. It takes up a whole lot of time. So normally those questions would be put into the chat, you know, by someone who really wants to have their voice heard, but they're not going to verbalize it, but they can type. So disseminate it ahead of time, pace yourself so you give people a chance to interact. So in other words, be patient, slow down a little bit. Yeah. And I guess also try and listen to the other, you know, be welcoming. And if someone doesn't agree with you, that's okay. You know, maybe I'm wrong about something. We're talking about people from all over the globe and all different ages, ethnicities, belief systems. You know, we do make a lot of mistakes and most of them are inadvertent, but fortunately, I think diplomacy is coming back now.
Yeah.
At least, hopefully, yeah. I think it definitely is. And that's key in any interaction, don't you think, around the world with these kind of mediums?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. And one of the things I always say is that, again, going back to the world of exhibitions, and when we work with clients with exhibitions, the first thing that we say is, it's not about you.
Good.
It's about your target audience. So I think you have to show humility. You have to understand your target audience at a deep level. And that means doing your homework in terms of, you know, their mindset, their communication, you know, look at the local culture as well, understand how they actually think and what might offend them. So, and it even goes back to, you know, picking your virtual background and looking at, you know, are there any symbols there that might offend people? So,
precisely. So
yeah, absolutely.
Or colors.
Yeah.
Numbers.
That's a great point. Absolutely, yeah. I think numbers play a big part in China, don't they, in Asia?
Yes, you know, you want to think about the feng shui of your room. You want to think about the numerology involved in, you know, what time, what date you pick for your Zoom meeting or your webinars or your events. Yeah. You want an auspicious date, like August. Yeah. August is a good month because it's eight, you know. If you can have a major event on August 8th, that's a pretty good date. You might get some good play out of that, but don't do it on April 4th. Okay. Yeah. That's 4-4. It sounds like to die. Yeah. So you need to have some sensitivity to all of those visual elements and the verbal and the nonverbal. It's a complicated issue.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And I think kiss, bow, shake hands is such a valuable resource. Where can they get hold of the book, Terry?
Thank you. There's the ebook version on Amazon and also the hard copy of all of my books. They're all there. Also, I have the digital version, a free one on Germany on our website. And I'm doing these little crossword puzzles too for clients now, and they're free on the site. I like to see people engage. So if anyone is interested in further data, has questions, I'm Terry Morrison at getcustoms.com.
Brilliant. It's been absolutely amazing having you on this podcast, Terry. I really appreciate your time. And I look forward to catching up with you in person somewhere in the US on the trade show circuit, no doubt.
I hope in the near future, Lee. It's been a pleasure.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. There you have it. The great Terry Morrison. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. And the links to Terry's website is on the podcast overview notes. And we look forward to seeing you on the next podcast. Thank you very much, everyone. Bye-bye.